Happy New Year!
It's not that time yet, Al. We're still a couple weeks away. We're still a couple of weeks away.
All right, start the show, Jeff.
You started the show. It's This Week in Mormons, everyone. Your weekly dose of Mormon news and commentary, humor, and even pathos.
Your fun, sexy time with Jeff and Al.
Yes, it's wunderbar. We are so excited to be here with you guys. Merry Christmas once again as we wind down the years. We wind down our fifth year of TWIM, folks. Very exciting.
We have a surprise for you today. In the box with the bow, it's Russell Stevens.
Russell Stevens'
Russell,
son,
welcome.
Al. Know his name.
I wasn't done. Stevens' son. Russell, you're there, right? Aren't you there, buddy?
I'm right here, gentlemen.
He's like so apprehensive now. You've done this before, Russell. You don't need to fear us. It's okay. It's going to be okay.
We're on your side, friend.
No, I'm afraid. No, it is not you that I fear. It's things about you that I fear.
That's fair.
It's a fine distinction.
So is this, because Russell was on the show a year ago. I feel like we had a rollicking good time. But maybe now that he's Mr. Book Publishing PhD student, he's going to try to rein it in a little bit, maybe.
Do not accidentally ask him how his master's
You need
is
to understand
going.
Something about graduate students. Graduate students cease to enjoy anything.
Let me counter that point by explaining to you what my life was like when I was a graduate student, Russell.
Jeff, you were only a master's student. You have no idea what it's like
to be
a master's PhD
degree,
candidate.
And it was delightful. Oh, the time.
Russell, isn't it
what
true
are you a master
that your graduate
of?
Robes will have a puffy hat?
What were you a master of?
I am a master of science in nationalism studies. I am an expert on separatist movements from a sociological and political standpoint.
Also making the big Montana at Arby's. That's what that translates into.
Yeah, pretty much. It's a very marketable degree.
It's a great degree. You had some cool stuff you researched.
That means you're a better patriot than all of us. I commend you for that.
I don't care much about I don't care much about America. I wrote my dissertation on Catalan nationalism using examples from Moldova, the Baltics, and elsewhere as supporting.
Very good.
Did you use any examples from Ukraine, Jeff?
Of course. I wrote an entire paper actually comparing the Orange Revolution to Spain's transition to democracy, comparing and contrasting the two different models used. I did
see,
very
this
well.
Is where I'm stroking my beard and I'm impressed, right?
As a fellow graduate student,
it's like, this is sufficiently pretentious. I approve.
Yes. Well, Russell, by the way, so you know, Russell is actually wearing a nice black turtleneck. He is rocking the grad student.
He is the Sprockets.
He's killing
Welcome
it.
Welcome to the Sprockets.
Yes.
I'm excited.
And unfortunately, you know, there's only so far that a good Mormon graduate student can go, right?
Well, that's true. I mean, you got to keep the law of chastity. That's true, definitely.
Yeah, there's that.
For sure.
But, you know, it's like we go to these pubs, and you're listening to some great music, and you're fitting in, and then all of a sudden it's like, hey, would you like something to drink? Why, yes, sir, I would. I'll take some water.
Yeah.
That would be fabulous.
Oh, I'm a ginger ale man. I like to sip my ginger ale slow. Yeah.
I feel your pain, dude. I mean, because I went to grad school in Scotland, and so we'd go pubbing, and I would just, you just hang out, but it's all you can do. At least you might be a peculiarity, a word I can't say, to your, you know, if you're the Mormon guy in a non-Mormon place, they might think it's interesting.
No, it's true. There's a certain curiosity about you. And with me, my dissertation is on Mormonism in Nigeria, which that automatically, elicits this visceral response like, wow, that's a thing. Is that not a contradiction in terms? It's like they can't even imagine the possibility of a Mormon like not looking like Mitt Romney, you know?
That's true. Now
we all do look like Mitt Romney, though. That's the funny
today
thing.
We are all Romneys.
We are tag Romneys times three.
So I just finished up with 30 Rock once more, and I forgot how many awesome Mormon jokes they have in season 6 and 7 because of Mitt Romney's campaign. That's all. It was just delightful. They even make the whole Leap Day episode. They even make jokes about how Mormons don't celebrate Leap Day.
Your life, Jeff. You just said I finished 30 Rock again.
Yeah, meaning I used to watch it on TV until it went off the air, and now I watched
it. What is it like to get to watch seasons over and over again of old TV shows.
I like that you're mocking me.
It's called Netflix.
You watched seven seasons of The West Wing, Al. That episodes that are twice as long as a 30 Rock episode.
One time. I'd never have said, I watched West Wing again.
Okay.
And the thing that I noticed about
You want to know something? Hold on. You want to know something about West Wing? The West Wing theme song is my alarm in the morning.
That a boy.
Ba-da-da. Ba-da-da.
No, that's Sports
not
Center.
The West Wing.
Al, what about news radio? Are you going to tell me you haven't watched news radio multiple times through?
All right. News radio, I step back. I've watched that a number of times. Then. It's a classic that has no time.
Yeah, news
it's
radio, amazing. The timeless program of our days. That's the one that when they open the time capsule 100 years from now, it will definitely be news radio.
If it had a likeness of Joe Rogan and Andy Dick in there, I think people would just smile. I think they would know exactly what we were trying to say. Yeah. Have a little fun, future self. Have a little fun.
Now, Russell, since you told me you were writing stuff about Mormons in Nigeria.
No, since we talked, Russell, you had a book about black people and a book about black people again, yes?
I had one book about an individual black person in the Mormon tradition. That was Black Mormon, the Story of Elijah Abels, and we had a nice chat about that moons ago. But the second book, you might call it the sequel, right? It's an expansion of the first book. It's called For the Cause of Righteousness, A Global History of Blacks and Mormonism.
Is it a global history of black Mormons or a global history of blacks and Mormons? Because those can be totally different
That's
topics.
An important question. And there's a reason I entitled the book in the way that I did. Because I didn't just want to tell the story of black Mormons, though that's important. I wanted to talk about the interconnections and the interchange between the black community and the Mormon community. Even for those blacks who were not necessarily in the church, they still had some kind of interchange with the Mormon community. There was a conversation and a dialogue going, and I wanted to tap into that conversation.
Okay. So,
keep going. Are there stories about this? Like, what are some highlights of this book that you're working on? Give me one or two.
This book is out now. It's not, I'm not working on it anymore. Like it's really, you can buy it right now. The first I saw
Do
the
I,
first purchase
If I
copy
promise
in
to
hand.
Buy a copy, will you tell me a story about it?
Only if you
I promise.
Promise. Okay. That,
yeah, done.
Let's make it clear this is a quid pro quo. All right. Do we have a witness?
Yes.
We have a
yes,
witness.
Yeah,
I'll
yeah, buy
yeah.
a copy.
I'm a witness. I'm here.
Witness. All right. It's done. So all right. Fun fact. In the 1930s, there was a man by the name of William P. Daniels who lived in Mowbray, South Africa, and he was one of a handful of black Latter-day Saints in South Africa at that time. He was also a branch president. Now,
sorry,
in 2014...
Sorry, what year was this again?
This was in the 1930s.
Okay, sorry, I just want to get context. Thank you.
Continue. And the year's important. You know, in this day and age, Oestreichus is rather, you know... is rather a conventional, right?
Well, this is obviously pre-President McKay kind of weighing lineage and all that stuff in South Africa, right? So,
right. It was in the 1950s, you know, that's when President McKay began to say that, you know, whites would no longer need to prove that their lineage came from outside of Africa. But right. Understand that William P. Okay. Daniels, he was clearly a black South African, and yet he was set apart as a branch president. He was head over a branch that was called the Branch of Love.
And, that sounds made up.
Oh, man.
You know?
That's in Provo
it's,
now,
it's
actually,
all true.
Right?
It's, apparently, they have established an outpost in Provo, so I hear it. No, I'm just kidding. That's not what? True, everybody. yeah. So it's a rather moving story of how, like, you know, this branch was made up primarily, if not exclusively, of his family members. And they... you know, they read Jesus the Christ together. They, you know, obviously read the Book of Mormon voraciously, and he gained such a rapport with the local leadership that they felt it necessary to give him some kind of authority, even though they could not give him the priesthood at this time.
Huh. So what?
Wait, so he
go ahead, Al.
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Al. It's fine.
I was going to say he was able to serve as branch president without the priesthood,
that,
or was that
was
like
my question?
A,
yeah.
Was that like, did they have some sort of jerry-rigged workaround, or was it full-on like, dude, you're good
to
go?
They called him a branch president. He went by the title of branch president. He was that's how he was listed in the official mission literature. But they determined that in order to be a branch president over one's own family, that, you know, you did not need the priesthood to do that. That, you know, that kind of came with one's patriarchal authority.
So the but the branch then only consisted of his family? That was it?
That's correct.
Okay. Where, so where was this town in South Africa where he lived?
Mowbray. It was not far from Cape Town.
Okay.
That is pretty cool. Dude, that's awesome. Give me one more, a little teaser. Just one more teaser, all the we can move on.
Well, we don't have to move on. This is more exciting than anything I do. Anyway, yeah, continue.
Jeff, we were going to talk about the top five Mormon gifts this year.
Well, we'll get to all that stuff. But I love Russell because he has this just wealth of knowledge of all these things that I know nothing about. It's very interesting. So
one of my favorite stories about the development of the church in Africa is how the church developed in Ghana. And there was a man by the name of Raphael Abraham F. Mensah, and he was a schoolmaster, and he wanted to establish a school in Ghana, and he was visiting his friend in the United Kingdom, a woman by the name of Lillian Clark. Now, Lillian Clark, she was an interesting figure in her own right because she was a Sufi mystic. And now Sufism is a branch of Islam that particularly values, you know, the visionary experience, right? The attempt to, you know, connect with the transcendent divine and, you know, becoming one with, you know, with the divine essence and that sort of thing. And she claimed to be having visions of figures from the Book of Mormon after meeting with sister missionaries from the United States. She met up with Raphael Abraham F. Mensah, and she passed on the literature and said, listen, you really need to look into these people. So he takes the literature back to Ghana, and he establishes his own congregation. And among the leaders of his congregation was a woman by the name of Rebecca G. Mould, and she was called the prophetess. You know, she headed her own group. You know, they had tremendous visionary experiences, and she was well regarded by her male peers. She even got to the point where she was considered to be an apostle in the Ghanaian church. Mind you, all of this is without any kind of acknowledgement by the American church leadership.
So is that guy, do you know, is he any relation to the, there was a, like a 70 that just got released a couple years ago by the name of Mensah.
You know, Mensah is a fairly common Ghanaian last name.
It is.
So there is a possibility that there's a relation there. To be honest, I don't know. But yeah, it's common enough to where they wouldn't necessarily need to be related.
Is this why Kate Kelly moved to Kenya? Does she feel like it's more fertile ground for her to be regarded as a prophetess? I'm just curious.
You know, all roads lead back to Kate Kelly, it seems. I write for Rational Face, and they said, just put the name Kate Kelly in the title of your piece. Just figure out a way, because it'll spike the hits by 1,000.
It's much better for SEO, too. It does its job. She is a firecracker. So... now, do you have any story? Obviously, Africa is an understandable base of operations for all this sort of research. But what about, like, are there outside of Africa with the history of blacks and the church?
Fiji, perhaps.
Right. Well, Fiji, that is an interesting case, if only because, you know, for many years, LDS church leaders, they considered Fijians to be descendants of Cain or descendants of Ham.
Yeah, I mean, didn't they have a priesthood ban in Fiji, too? Yeah.
But then during President David O. McKay's tenure as president of the church, he determined that it really shouldn't be based on skin color, the priesthood ban, but rather it should be based on, on one's connection to Africa. You know, so if you have a clearly delineated connection to African ancestry, that is what prohibited you from holding the priesthood. And that left the... left it open for the Fijian population. I just blew your mind, didn't I?
Al, is this your first time hearing? Is this your first time hearing this, Al?
Yeah. I didn't. How messed up is that?
Yeah.
Now, hold on. It's not about the skin color. It's really, this is all about Africans.
Yes.
Well,
that was the. That was the thought process of David O. McKay.
Well, you had to trace your lineage to black Africans, though, right? I mean, if you traced your lineage for some reason to old white, you know, Boer
settlers. Of course. Yeah. Yeah, that goes without saying.
You're fine, yeah.
Right? But they come from, you know, European stock, right? They
exactly.
They are native Africans, really. I mean, they identified as Africans. They said, I am African. But by today's nomenclature, you know, you would say that they're really Afrikaner, which is really Dutch or maybe British.
Yeah. What about like non-black Africans? And I don't just mean, you know,
white.
No,
people.
Well, I don't mean like Arabs or even people from like Madagascar. People from Madagascar aren't black, for example. Like, what about how were they all treated with all of this?
I mean, if you looked like what they deemed to be, you know, a black African, I mean, then you were assumed to be African, right? Or let's say even in Brazil, for example. Brazil was the leading site for the slave trade throughout the history of the slave trade. So the chances of a person in Brazil having an African ancestor, incredibly high, right? I mean, unless, you know, sometimes, you know, the Germans, you know, they managed to steer clear from it because, you know, they're committed to racial segregation.
Those Germans, they always did one thing well, huh?
Something like that. But the vast majority of people had some African blood going through them. So it wasn't at all unusual for, you know, a missionary in Brazil to be teaching somebody. And then you might see a picture on the wall and you say, oh, their grandmother looks African. Or, you know, they would use the word Negroid, right? They look somewhat, quote, Negroid. And then you would start asking the person that they were teaching, hey, so, you know, do you have African ancestry? They say, well, you know, like most people do. And that effectively ended the discussions.
No way. So, yes. So like if there was any African in you, it was just if that was part of your
heritage. They did have what's called, like a seventh discussion of sorts, where, you know, in this discussion, you know, you would lay out, okay, here's what it means, right? If you want to join this church, then, you know, you're not going to be able to hold the priesthood. And here's why it's, you know, here's why it's a policy. And it dates all the way back to Joseph Smith. And, you know, it was set out like any of the other discussions. So, you know, that was there, right?
Brazil was kind of a driving factor in a lot of the, I mean, we know we believe things come via revelation, but I know that a lot of the potential growth in Brazil was really in what pushed the church in the 70s to sort of reassess, if I'm not mistaken, because there it wasn't so clear cut. Like, yeah,
true, Russell?
We didn't just have white people and black people. Brazil is very mixed race, even today, very multi-ethnic with everybody. And so I believe, Russell can refute this, of course, but I thought, my understanding was that Brazil in particular played a very major role in reassessing the policy on priesthood ordination.
Yes, it did absolutely play a major role. And James E. Faust, you know, he had a top level position in the church at this time, and he served his mission in Brazil. He had been a civil rights attorney. He certainly had the best reputation for, you know, supporting the plight of black Americans as well as black Brazilians and others. And he was actively pushing for church leaders to start, you know, revisiting the policy based on the Brazilian experience. That being said, you know, when we talk about what caused Official Declaration Number 2 in 1978, we always need to be careful, right? We can't just say this one thing caused it or this force caused it. It was, you know, really it was a convergence of forces, right? It was a constellation of influences. I mean, you have Africa pushing on.
That is good PhD talk. That is really good PhD talk.
You know, you have the African influence. You have the civil rights movement. You know, you have Brazil. You have a number of things. So,
for sure. Yeah.
Whenever we start trying to isolate the variable on this, that's when we start going astray. And it's something to do so because, I mean, it can be useful for conversations and it can help simplify the narrative. But at the end of the day, we can't really nail it down to one group of people that caused this change to come about. Well,
Nick, can we circle back to my mind being blown? Really?
Yes, I always want to hear about your mind being blown because that's a red letter day when that happens. I mean, really.
Yes. So what was the church's response when David O. McKay, like, did he come out and say this in a general conference? Like, what was the shift in policy? What drove that? Was it just him being like, no, you know, I'm fine with everybody. It's just really those African people. But which is bizarre to me because David O. McKay was like the one of the head guys in like BYU Hawaii and a lot of the, you know, the church high schools and stuff throughout the Pacific Islands was his driving force.
Understand what? That decision.
Why pick on Africans?
Right. Well, I mean, that decision was actually opened up opportunities to a lot of people. It opened it up to the Fijians, for example.
Well, yeah, his favorite people, the Asia Pacific group. But what about the Africans?
Right. I mean, that's a question that you could ask throughout the history of the church, right? I mean, you know, you have Brigham Young, John Taylor, et cetera, where they didn't even think to, you know, if you were black, it was just assumed that you were African and that you were a descendant of Cain. Just assumed. Didn't even ask.
And that's the rationale, is Africa was settled by Cain.
I don't think that they would have thought through it that much, except that if you were black, that you were a descendant of Cain and or Ham.
Dang. Okay.
Al, I encourage Al, maybe I'll get it for you for Christmas. Russell, you've probably read the book, David O. McKay and the Rise of Modern Mormonism.
Yes. Excellent book.
Excellent book. And it actually talks a lot about it. I don't remember every detail.
I'm just going to read Russell's books, Jeff.
Okay.
Thanks.
Maybe he sources that. I don't know.
I do. Prince did a tremendous job. I mean, there's no way that you can talk about the McKay administration and race without citing Prince.
Yeah. And that book really opened up my eyes to a lot of the stuff that did go down. But like you said, I believe that even though it seems so backwards to even make people need to prove a lineage, so to speak, it also did actually open up the doors to some who could say, you go back X number of generations. And there, because at some point, didn't they make like a cutoff? Like, you could say, like, oh, if you're so far back to find your first black ancestor,
well,
it doesn't matter.
Towards
anymore,
the end of the 19th century, that.
So this was a
step
towards
forward. The end of, towards the end of the 19th century, church leaders began to employ what was called the one drop rule, which was that if you had one drop of African blood in you, that was sufficient for prohibiting you from holding the priesthood. And we don't really have evidence of that policy being articulated during, you know, the administration of, let's say, Brigham Young, or we do begin to see it around John Taylor, Wilford Woodruff, but certainly not during Brigham Young's time. And it's around the same time that you begin to see this sort of language also being employed throughout the Jim Crow South, right? You know, if you have one drop of black blood in you, that makes it illegal for you to go to certain restaurants. That makes it illegal for you to drink from certain drinking fountains, etc.
Wow. I had no idea. I really didn't. I thought, well, I didn't realize that the policy changed. In retrospect, I should have assumed that it would have been, and clarified a number of times and articulated. And none of those conversations around, like, well, what do you mean black Santa and the priesthood? Oh, well, I mean if there's one drop, or if their lineage goes back. I mean, the fact that you'd have to articulate this sort of bigoted policy would continue. It'd make you look kind of foolish from today's standards, right? And so I guess I should have figured that would be in there somewhere.
In 1954, you know, that's when President McKay, I mean, he not only did it for the Fijians, but in South Africa, he told white South Africans, listen, if you look white, then that's enough. Whereas before, you needed to prove that every single one of your ancestors came from Europe. The genealogical burden that this placed on South African genealogists, to me, was tremendous. It was impossible. And I do talk about that at some length in my book, the efforts of South African and Brazilian genealogists to try to prove pure non-African lines.
It's kind of Voldemort-esque, isn't it? I feel like we're talking mudbloods and purebloods. No, but like, I mean, it's a joke.
We got some Hermione Grangers in here. We don't know what to do.
But it almost sounds like that. I mean, I'm not trying to make it. It's the first thing that just popped in my head. Like, you see those exact same parallels of like, yeah, you got to prove your purity of blood to be considered part of the club of this.
The pure blood prince?
That's the half blood prince, Al. How dare you?
I knew it.
I think it's fat. So where did you, like, where does one do research for all this sort of stuff? I mean, I'm assuming you've been stateside. Have you been to Africa? Do you have to get out there and really get into some of the libraries on site? Are most of your sources LDS sources? Like, what's your process for really digging in deep and doing that deep dive on all of this?
Right. So, I mean, there are a number of different methods that you can use, you know, if you really want to get at the, you know, the Black Mormon experience, as well as the, you know, the shared experience of Blacks and white Mormons. First of all, I mean, obviously the archives, they play a central role in any kind of, you know, LDS history endeavor.
The church archives?
The LDS church archives, but also other archives as well. I mean, I found some tremendous documents at Weber State University from a man named Caleb Shreve, who was a fairly outspoken defender of the priesthood ban. You know, he said that those who were pushing to lift the ban were communists, and that they were, you know, trying to destabilize the church, et cetera, et cetera. A fascinating figure. He sounds like a crank, but he was actually a very well-respected man for his time. And I do talk about him somewhat as well. So the archival experience is an important one. You know, you try to find as many original documents as you possibly can. You find letters, you find journals. You know, you end up spending a lot of hours looking at microfilm. In the case of the Church History Library, you know, some of the most fascinating documents were meeting minutes that I found from William P. Daniels's, you know, cottage meetings before Daniels became the branch president. So this is around the same time that, you know, Daniels was beginning to experience some racial segregation, you know, in his church community. Time out, gentlemen. Can you hear that background sound?
Yeah.
You can.
Well, it sounds like you got a Girl Scout selling cookies. She knocked
okay.
on the door.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that everything was kept.
Oh, I actually assumed Al was messing with something in his kitchen.
Dang it, Jeff, I am.
Okay, I wanted to see how sensitive it was. All right, so let me pick up where I left off.
Are you on a treadmill right now, Russell?
I'm that good. I can pontificate about Black Mormons and run. See, is there anything I can't do? As we were. Yes. If we can edit that out, that'd be great. So
I say leave it. I like this.
Please no. So this is around the same time that William P. Daniels, he's experiencing racial segregation in the LDS community. So he and his family kind of close ranks, and they kept close minutes, very intimately detailed minutes as to what they did. And this is where we find out that they're reading Jesus Christ. They were singing, "Oh, My Father," which is, you know, that great hymn by Eliza R. Snow about, you know, about the existence of heavenly parents, not just a heavenly father. So the archives are important, but also oral history, right? I interviewed a woman by the name of Kathy Stokes, who, you know, she joined the church shortly after Official Declaration Number 2, and she also played a very important role in getting Ghana to allow the church back in after Ghana had kicked the church out, you know, in the late 1980s, early 1990s. So her experiences were, I mean, that interview was a real gem, because she was able to offer us like the equivalent of high level LDS church diplomacy. Like, how does a church deal with international crises? So
wait,
international crises.
The church was kicked out of Ghana because it had a ban on Blacks in the priesthood.
That played a role, but that wasn't the only problem. Another problem was that the church tended to, they had a very high profile as wealthy Americans, and this was best symbolized in their ownership of cars. See, we think of cars as being pretty ordinary, right? Anybody can own a car in America. In Ghana, not anybody can own a car. People who are ridiculously wealthy can own a car.
I should go there to date. I'd be like a king. I have a car. I have a lunch pail.
You would definitely be seen as a wealthy American.
As a wealthy white American.
As a wealthy white American, and we would see
they
how you fare.
They love me down there.
I love Ghanaians.
This didn't set well with the Ghanaian government, right? Because in their eyes, we were just a bunch of wealthy capitalists who were trying to, you know, to run things. And, you know, for years, Ghana had been trying to shake off the colonial influence. And here the Americans were looking like the same kind of colonists that had been there for generations. So the church was ousted from the country. Godmakers, you know, made by Ed Decker, that played a role in it as well. There are a number of things. But certainly,
really?
Mormon wealth played a role in this as well.
It makes sense too. I mean, because Ghana has a different history than a lot of Africa, at least because, you know, it was the first post-colonial state in Africa. What was it, 54? I think they got independence. So they definitely had their own.
Yeah, Kwame Nkrumah was like one of the, you know, the great post-colonial leaders of Africa, you know, leading the way in shaking off the colonial influence. So yes, Ghana valued
shake it off. I think Taylor Swift. Every
that's
time.
Understandable. Me too.
Okay,
I've got shake a blank off. Space, baby.
So Russell, you mentioned that you the book is also about the interactions of, or some of the impressions of, the general black population on the Mormon church. Can you talk mm-hmm. a little bit about like the blacks that weren't Mormons and what impact that might have had on Mormonism, or like what did you find with that?
Well, certainly. So, you know, in the mid 1960s, the NAACP in Salt Lake City, they saw the church as something of an obstacle to carrying out their civil rights objectives. And in fall of 1963, to be exact, they threatened a march on Temple Square. They said, unless you get behind civil rights legislation, we need to make a spectacle of this, because we think that, you know, the priesthood ban is playing a major role in preventing Utahns from supporting civil rights legislation. They use a priesthood ban to say, okay, well, it only makes sense that, you know, businesses have the right to exclude black people from their premises. So in an 11th hour deal that, you know, a man by the name of Stephen Holbrook and to some degree Sterling McMurrin, who was a professor at the University of Utah, struck with church leaders. They said, okay, we will call off the march if you release some kind of statement this weekend at General Conference. Hubie Brown, you know, who was then the first counselor in the first presidency, he stood up and he delivered a very general statement supporting civil rights. You know, he didn't support any particular piece of legislation, but just said that the church supports civil rights for all mankind, etc. So what that did was it at least threw the NAACP bones. Like, okay, at least on some level, in some sort of vague general way, the church does support civil rights legislation. But this was not the end of the conflict. You end up seeing there be something of an awkward, awkward tug of war between the church and the NAACP over the course of the next few years. But then when you see the riots break out in Detroit and Baltimore in 1967, that really makes it difficult for church leaders like Ezra Taft Benson to look beyond that. And they end up going in the other direction and start saying the civil rights movement is part of the vast worldwide communist conspiracy take over American liberty. And
Did he say that?
Yeah, President Benson said that.
Yeah. In General Conference.
Not Benson.
In General Conference.
Oh, Benson said all sorts of things. His
Secretary of Agriculture.
His whole affiliation with the John Birch Society, that's a whole...
He was never a member of the John Birch Society, to be clear, but he was supportive of their aims.
Well, President McKay wouldn't let him, basically. They kept trying to make him a member, and President McKay just kept saying... trying to hold him off.
Yeah.
What is the John Birch Society? Should I know what that is?
The John Birch Society is, or what? I guess it's not really that active. I guess it exists still. Right?
It does still exist. I've met John Birchers.
It's a far right organization with pretty hardcore right wing objectives.
Tea Partiers. Sure.
Tea Partiers on acid. That's the way I'll describe it. Tea Partiers. On acid.
And Ezra Taft Benson was a fan of what they did. He was sympathetic.
He was a sympathizer. Yeah, I'd say he was a sympathizer, and they wanted more association from him, especially because he was prominent in the Eisenhower administration. But the church repeatedly kind of tried to rein President Benson in. It's funny to see all the stuff that goes on during the McKay era, because you've got Hubie Brown, who's more liberal, trying to push for stuff, and Ezra Taft Benson going on his end, and President McKay's trying to kind of balance everybody.
And you've got James E. Faust, who's also like widely renowned as, you know, as a supporter of civil rights. So yeah. It is a rather interesting coalition that President McKay is trying to navigate here. And Elder Benson, he makes an interesting comment in his October 67 speech, in which he talks about, quote, knowledgeable Negroes unquote, who know better than to buy into all this communist malarkey. And he's referring, he doesn't name them by name, but he's referring to a very small but very loud contingent of African Americans who actually did affiliate with the John Birch Society and distance themselves from the Civil Rights Movement and from Martin Luther King Jr.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Gentlemen, we grew up in a more progressive time. What can we say? Even with the issues we are clearly still facing today, it was a very different world even in the decades before any of us jumped.
Well, because Ezra Taft Benson, I know he had some, like, I mean, he's an outspoken guy, and I always just kind of chalked it up to, like, oh, well, he was against communism. Good, me too. I've never really gone in and studied his remarks.
Yeah,
sounds like there's some good fodder.
Ezra Taft Benson saying that the civil rights movement was a communist front, I think, is one. When I first read that, that was one of those things I was like, oh my goodness, you can see a lot of things, but that's one of those things you read and you're just like, product of the times, man, 50s and 60s. Yeah. That's just.
Yeah, I mean, there was something about watching Detroit burning. That really inflamed people. Now, understand, too, that, you know, Benson, he believed these things even before Detroit. But, you know, when you're seeing a city on fire and it's, you know, and it's African-Americans who are participating in it, it just sends off all kinds of racial triggers. And, you know, it leads people like Ezra Taft Benson to start saying things that he did in General Conference. And with some support from President McKay.
Well, it's a good thing things like that don't happen anymore. We don't have racial problems or black communities burning down cities or protesting. I'm glad we're living in a post-racial society now in the U.S. We've done good things.
So Russell, I mean, is there anything that's sort of been difficult for you to swallow from your studies where you just like in these conversations? I mean, there's stuff that. For me, I'm like, oh, man, we did that? Really? Do you have any tips for sort of navigating some of this and keeping your testimony intact?
And staying active in the church.
Well, yeah. The best way I can approach that question is by telling a small slice of my own story and of my own background and really the inspiration from the book. So one thing you need to understand about my family, about Stevenson's. We love ourselves.
Well, you're a PhD candidate. You have every right.
You know, Stevenson's are obsessed with who we are. And like we give high-minded speeches about where we came from and, you know, the future of the Stevenson family. And we have a national anthem of sorts, to be quite honest. And we, if we were given the opportunity to start a country, we would. So.
Okay. As the master of nationalism studies, I might have a thing or two to say about your nationalist.
Please continue. And the patriarch of all this, his name was Stanley Stevenson, my grandfather. He was a police officer in Los Angeles in the years leading up to the Watts riots. And
also a character on The Office. I like this.
And he had some racial difficulties. Okay, but he was a hero in our family. Okay, he loomed large. He was, you know, the work his fingers to the bone kind of guy. He went to law school for years and years, hoping that he could someday pass the bar exam. Just so many honorable things about him, and you know, his family all stayed active in the church. At least, you know, for the most part, and even those who don't stay active, they still are close to us, and it's one of those success stories, right? And then. To hear him say the things that he did about the African American population, it was very difficult for us. And even towards the end of his life, someone asked him if he would ever want these views to be passed on to his children or grandchildren, and he said, no, I wouldn't. So that begs the question for me, how could someone who's so good in so many ways be so wrong about something so important? And that's been what has been most difficult for me to swallow is, you know, that part of my own family, my own flesh and blood. And I think to some degree that could be seen as a microcosm for, you know, the struggle that we all go through, because for many of us, the church is our family, right? You know, we may have a difficult relationship with it, but, you know, it's kind of, it's the cradle of our faith. And then when you find out that, that the people that we call our spirit, our spiritual flesh and blood, are doing and saying things that don't fit with what we believe to be moral and true and good. That's a hard thing. And it was a hard thing for our family as well. So I have struggled and I continue to struggle and seek to put things into perspective and to make sure that when I paint a portrait of a man like my grandfather, that I paint him, yes, warts and all, but that I don't let the wart become the man.
Yeah, that's actually a really good angle to take with that, because, I mean, in any of these guys or these, church history officials or brethren that we have, yeah, they got a couple of things dead wrong, but I think if the approach is let's not let the wart become the man, there's plenty of good, a lot of good, that comes out of it, but.
Yeah, and people, it's unfortunate because people will really kind of like, really just sort of fume over the warts, over the unfortunate imperfections of people. You know, even today, I mean, people look back at this church history and struggle with it. People will criticize our current leaders, and we use it. We'll take, these individual examples and try to use them to just totally deconstruct one's entire faith persuasion. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very unfortunate. I think it's great when we're able to work through things and maintain our faith. And like for you, Russell, it's obviously, you're dabbling in a lot of more than dabbling, but you're diving in on a lot of very, very heady issues for a lot of Latter-day Saints and sort of issues that have caused plenty of people to even leave the church of any race. Yeah. And it's a good testament to people when we can try to keep our eyes on the horizon, I guess you could say, and recognize sort of the, like, I like the way you said that perfectly, the warts, don't let the warts actually become the man. I think that's a good way to look at it.
And I was just going to add to that, and might add that some of these people who struggle with these kinds of issues, they do so on deeply principled grounds, right? This isn't them just looking for something to pick at, right?
Yeah, sure.
There was one individual by the name of John W. Fitzgerald. He was an EDD from Columbia, and he for years and years he inquired of the First Presidency, what action are you taking on this priesthood restriction? I don't understand. It doesn't fit with what I believe the gospel to be. And eventually he ended up leaving the church, even after the First Presidency commissioned James E. Faust to go try to reclaim him. While he, ultimately that did prove to be the demise of his membership in the church, I would never feel comfortable saying that he was anything other than sincere in his opposition to this kind of policy. That he wasn't just saying, hey, listen, I don't want to I don't want to keep the law of chastity. Right? I want to go get drunk, so I'm just going to say this about blacks in the priesthood. No, he believed in this firmly, deeply, and I think this is something that this is a kind of this is the kind of issue that that does keep people up at night, and we can recognize that in others.
So speaking of which, I'm curious, and I know this isn't your area of expertise, but I'm sure that you followed along with the essays on polygamy as those came out, because a lot of the conversations I've had as of late with people are. In this genre of conversation, right, of like keeping your faith, not letting the wart become the man sort of stuff is particularly around Joseph Smith and his practice of polygamy. Yes. Do you have any sort of thoughts to add to that conversation?
I mean, a lot has been said and by incredibly intelligent people. So, I preface my comments, with that gesture, acknowledging that some great people have gone before me in this, but I can say, in my own experience and in my own studies, and I have studied this, at some length, not anywhere near to the degree that Sam Brown or Brian Hales has. but my great, great, great aunt, Lucy Walker, was one of Joseph Smith's plural wives. And she, she wrote a rather lengthy autobiography explaining the intricacies of the proposal and the kind of deep soul-wrenching faith crisis that she went through. I mean, she she actually told him no at one point. She said she couldn't do it, but you know, she had this visionary experience telling her that, you know, that, you know, this is what was expected of her, and you know, she eventually felt some degree of calm. But the more important story with Lucy, in my mind, and the one that has spoken to me, is the interaction that she had with Joseph Smith's youngest son, David. David didn't know that his father had practiced polygamy. He grew up after his father's death, and he went to Utah on a kind of mission to reclaim the Brighamites, you know, to bring them back to the proper fold of the RLDS Church. His older brother, Joseph Smith III, he was becoming aware of it, but David didn't know anything. And he had a conversation with my great-great-great-aunt Lucy. And Lucy said, "Son, your father and I, we were married. It happened." And, you know, Emma, she had kept it from him just because, you know, she was so done with everything. She'd been so traumatized by it all that she didn't want this to be, you know, a part of the family dynamic. But he found out the truth. And while we have evidence to suggest that David was already somewhat unstable, we also know that a kind of a trigger for for his future descent into insanity was finding out this information. He spent the last 20 years of his life in an insane asylum.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, thinking about my own family's connection to that and, you know, the role that my ancestor played in communicating this information to me, to him, has made me feel that I also have that responsibility to tell the truth, and in a loving way. Lucy was very loving. She was gentle about it. She, you know, she didn't try to scandalize David, but she said, "This is who I am. This is what I've experienced, and really, this is part of your family's experience as well." So we have that obligation to be candid, but also to be Christ-like. That's my thoughts on how we come to grips with polygamy in our past.
Hmm. Yeah, that's great advice. I mean, like there really is no value in pretending like it didn't happen or trying to hide our head in the sand. You know, I think it's unfortunately it's become sort of a duty or responsibility of a member of the church to know. Well, not unfortunately, I guess. Fortunately, yeah, it's a good thing. We need to know our own church history. We need to understand what's gone on and be able to speak articulately to it. Because if we don't, I mean, then we have no opportunity to sort of promote truth,
right,
in these discussions.
And I've admittedly lived a charmed life. You know, I've had these stories floating around since I was a child, so I never went through this kind of radical transition. But boy, we've talked about a lot of serious and heady things tonight, gentlemen. I mean,
this is all good fun.
we can even pivot to now. Let's put it in more modern context. What about Mormons and torture? That's a thing.
Yeah, though. That is definitely the topic du jour, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, so for anyone who's been not paying attention, of course, they released a big torture report last week. It actually talked about torture techniques that happened years ago, but still, it happened, and it seems the depth of torturing was much worse than we imagined, and it doesn't seem that they got a lot out of it, even though they've pretended they have before. But the main scandal for Mormons is that the guys who designed the torture programs are members of the church. And so it's, you got Jana Reese writing about this. You've had a lot of blogs actually writing about the Mormon connection to torture and whether we as a people, like a lot of other things, have a responsibility to stand up and say, you know, we stand against torture. Like we as Latter-day Saints, even people are calling on top brass in Salt Lake to say, yeah, we are categorically against torture as a people. End of story. But it's very murky, and there's many different sides of this. I mean, you see the stuff with Bruce Jessen and all of those who designed the torture, and then we've got another article here from Hannah Wheelwright, who's very upset that that we spend time talking about the word of wisdom and modesty and all the other things that a lot of people say we talk about from the pulpit, when I don't think I've ever heard a conversation about capped sleeves from the pulpit in my life, but whatever.
She wants the church to make a statement on torture and on
and I everything I else. Think sometimes when we, and this is generalizing a bit, but I think when we it's I understand the longing to expect things like that, because it's basically like, if we can be culture warriors, we can go after gay marriage, you know, and we can, and the church even just recently issued a statement about Utah's healthcare legislation that it's okay with, that it wants to support a certain kind of thing. So I understand why many people say, well, why don't we talk about torture? All these other faiths are talking about torture.
Well, I was going to say,
the one thing that comes to mind is that we forget that the church isn't just speaking for the United States and its saints here. It has more members of the church outside of the U.S. than it does inside the U.S. And also, we like to play the long game with a lot of other countries where we're trying to get in. Like, we know fully well that China tortures people in all likelihood, right? But we still want to have friendly relations with the Chinese government. And there could be risk if we were to go out and just condemn.
You don't think they would guess that the Mormons should be against torture?
I don't know. But
we have a lot of Jesus and love in our doctrine. They might draw that conclusion.
We do, but I feel like the church tries to be very, very cautious and very methodical in approaching its relationship with newer countries and trying not to offend them.
All right, so we can get
inroads there. But that's just one.
That's just dumb. That's stupid.
Okay,
Jeff.
Fair enough.
No, the thing that I'm like sort of dwelling on with the torture piece is what are the conflicts for an LDS guy who's asked to work on the nuclear bomb or the conflicts that come in being an LDS guy and working for the CIA or being in some sort of spy culture where it's all lies.
The CIA does employ a lot of Mormons, but very few of them are involved in ops, typically speaking, anyway. Most of the time, they're more working in Langley doing analysis.
Yeah, like open source stuff. You know, they're reading newspapers.
Or they do plenty of top secret stuff. But as far as actual field ops, that is a lot. My understanding is that that's more rare for Mormons to be involved in, because a lot of them say, yeah, I don't know how principled I could be about being out in the field and doing all the shady stuff we have to do. I'd prefer to have my desk and do my research and still contribute to my country's security.
Well, and I don't necessarily agree with I'm not a fan of torture, but there's an element of this that like these guys, I mean, much like Nazi Germany, they're just doing their job, right? They're following orders. Their job is to come and create this thing and write this report, or like suggest methods and like
Jay Bybee. What? We haven't even talked about Jay Bybee, and that's yet another Mormon. Right?
What was Jay Bybee? What was his
name? He was a lawyer for the Bush administration, and he wrote a memo based on CIA advice that provided legal cover for a lot of these enhanced interrogation techniques.
And so, he's just doing his job.
Yeah. He's doing his Hannah Arendt called this the banality of evil, right?
Who is Hannah? Why do we care about Hannah?
Hannah Arendt, you know, she's a rather famous European philosopher, and she's done a lot of writing on the Holocaust.
European, anyway.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
but that's like the banality of evil, right? Where you specialize the structure so well, you compartmentalize it so well, so that way very few people actually need to feel like they're getting their hands dirty.
Yeah, yeah. Which was, we look back at Nazi Germany and we say, how could you ever do this? But I mean, any of the reading I've done on the Nazi movement, it's sort of easy to sympathize with the broad message of like sort of the socialism aspect, the we're going to be a great nation, we're going to get our feet back together. And the people that were following, like they were making good choices in their head, I feel like. I don't feel like all of them were just outright evil. I feel like their leader was evil and took them down a bad road. But the day-to-day operations, these are guys just trying to please their superiors, right?
Well, I got a couple things that pop in my mind. Because I mean, at the end of the day, you could look at like Nephi's example. If you're LDS, you could be saying, yeah, this stuff is awful, but this is what is necessary to maintain something better in a sense. Like, hey, if we don't go to these excessive lengths, and I'm very much playing devil's advocate here, but if we don't go to these...
Are you a fan of torture, Jeff?
No. Okay, now, I don't even believe in the Second Amendment. But this is what we have to do to preserve our way of life, to preserve a greater cause, a greater freedom, to preserve opportunities abroad. And it stinks But that's what it is. And the other thing that comes to mind that's not exactly related to torture, but I remember when the U.S. invaded Iraq, and President Hinckley actually made a statement about the war in General Conference, and he basically said, we want to reiterate that the soldiers who are carrying out their orders from their officers are not personally responsible for, you know, the killings and things that they will undertake. That is not on them. That is on their own leaders. They are just doing their duty. And I recognize that a soldier being in the...
That feels paraphrased.
No, well, it is paraphrased. And I recognize that a soldier in the field is different from, you know, dirty black ops doing what they do. It's a different game. But I also very vividly remember President Hinckley mentioning that when he talked about that. I don't know. Russell, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, you know, you look at the legacy that the Book of Mormon lays out for us, the theology of war, and it's quite ambivalent. Because, you know, you look at, you know, who is the great war hero of the Book of Mormon?
Teancum, obviously.
Teancum, right, the secret assassin.
No,
right?
Teancum's the best one. Slips into tents.
He is really good. He sneaks over the wall and stabs.
Who doesn't love him? Yeah. But no, if you look at the opinion of the authors of the Book of Mormon, or if you're not a believer, the author of the Book of Mormon, it's Captain Moroni, hands down, right? If everyone were like Captain Moroni, then the world would be such a better place, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you look at his wartime policies, and it called for summary executions. And why? I mean, not because, you know, you have people who are actively seeking to undermine the, undermine the government, but rather they're simply refusing to ally themselves with Captain Moroni's side.
Yeah.
And that was sufficient, in, as far as Moroni is concerned, to kill them. On the other hand, you have the Anti-Nephi Lehis, who, you know, they would rather die themselves than shed the blood of a brother. So, you know, what are we to make of these possibly conflicting notions within the Book of Mormon? In fact, are they conflicting? And, you know, this is sheer conjecture, but would Captain Moroni have supported torture? We know he supported killing those who refused to support, you know, Team Moroni, but would he have supported torture, and is there a difference?
Well, they did scalp Amalickiah, so...
Okay.
Right, there's that.
He's for scalping.
He's for scalping, okay. Which is still, I mean, as far as, like, is that an enhanced interrogation? No, that's just an act of ritual violence.
Imagine if we had war chapters like that, when they were like, and then we captured the Lamanite spies and we took them into our cave, during which we drove palm fronds into their cuticles to try to extract information.
Yes.
All right, yeah, I'm going to say no.
We
I'm
fed
say no.
them through their derrieres, right? I mean, no, that we don't have that. We do, the evidence that we do have of torture, I mean, it's done by the Nephites, and it's in Moroni chapter 9 when they're talking about, you know, like eating the flesh of the rape victims, right? It's just awful, right? Yeah. So, you know, you have these conflicting messages as to, okay, well, obviously harsh measures are required at certain times, and at other times, you know, you should be much more pacifistic. How do you draw that distinction? And then let's complicate the picture even more, right? Ever since the Latter-day Saints became part of the American community, which was, you know, in the 1890s, let's say, just roughly speaking, right? Polygamy was done. Utah was now officially a state, and it was expected that the Mormons would be like any other good American. And this is the first time that you see some this kind of Mormon patriotism starting to bubble up within the Mormon community, right? The idea that Mormons would be exceptionally good Americans.
Oh yeah, we loved America.
Right, but you know, in the 1850s, if a Mormon had called another Mormon an American, that would be a pretty cutting insult, right? You did not want to be called an American in 1850s Utah.
Sure.
Well, then we can speak to all that. So, I mean, half of that I feel like was on the petition for statehood, basically. I mean, the church, everyone said, we love America. We're going to put bunting and the U.S. flag over the temple. We're going to show them how American we are so they can give us statehood so that we don't have to have federally appointed territory.
Oh, no, but I understand. They refused to call themselves, I mean, okay, for example, during the Utah War, right? They said, the Americans are coming.
Yeah,
they
for sure.
They didn't
yeah.
say that the enemy's coming. They didn't say Johnson's armies are coming, though they said, I mean, they did say that, but they said as well, the Americans are coming. So
okay.
The American identity, that wasn't something really affiliated with. Yes, they wanted statehood, but only so they could establish an independent, like you said, you know, they wanted to be free from federal influence. But that was the extent of it. It wasn't due to any kind of love for the country of America.
But does any part of you, of course, I'm trying to think about when this would line up with the Civil War as far as the years. Do you also feel like any sense of a lack of American identity also stemmed from the fact that there was a weaker federal system in the first place before the Civil War? I mean, maybe this happened after the Civil War and we didn't have as strong of a federal oversight over everything, you know, but even before the Civil War, plenty of people didn't feel as...
We're talking 1890s right now, Jeff. We're coming up around the end of the Civil War. Like
the Civil War,
I know what you're saying, though. Like the American identity, like, you know, as Shelby Foote said, you know, the Civil War turned us from an R into an is. Right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, American identity is kind of a construct of Reconstruction era.
I wouldn't go quite that far. But, I mean, you do have some elements of national identity even as early as the Revolutionary War.
Sure, okay. Sure, sure.
And, you know, people did talk about, you know, America. And but for Mormons, yes. I mean, they took the idea of, you know, a separatist identity. And, I mean, they really ran with it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, to the point where they talked about all of America as being Babylon. Right. Whereas, you know, if you were a person living in Illinois, living in 1850s Illinois, you wouldn't have said, yeah, we're all everyone else is Babylon, but I'm a member of the Illinois community.
I'm an
Illinoisan,
yeah.
Right. Whereas Mormons, like, you know, you're all going to self-destruct, and that's why we don't really care about the Civil War. In fact, we hope you all die, essentially.
Wait, and this mentality is circa 2004?
Yeah, circa 2000. No, not circa 2000.
I feel like that's accurate. I feel like that there still is a sentiment of everywhere else is Babylon. We are the chosen.
No,
I
would give
Utah.
It circa 2008, maybe. Maybe that would be more appropriate
okay,
year,
yeah.
I think.
Oh, man. But,
trying to throw that on.
But the point of all this is towards the turn of the 20th century, World War I, so on, that's when you begin to see this discourse where Mormons are good patriots. They do as they're told to prove that we're done with that weird 19th century, you know, the weird polygamy stuff.
So are we doing like a bunch of random crap? Like what were we doing?
What do you mean what were we doing?
Were we doing things that compromised our beliefs, our morals?
I mean that's
in order to show patriotism.
I don't know if we were doing things that necessarily compromised our morals, but we were going out of our way to prove that we were patriotic. Like we would give voice to, you know, how great America was. We would actively seek to recruit people to join, you know, with the forces during World War I. Right? We would talk, like Heber J. Grant would stand up in general conference and talk and basically toe the American party line when it came to what side they should take, you know, in World War I, right? They'd say, yeah, the Germans, they're evil, right? The Germans are evil, but we're good, et cetera, et cetera. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Does that make sense to you, Al?
Is that enough of a reference for you?
Sorry, that probably sounded overly condescending.
You're a graduate student. You're going to be a doctor soon.
No, I'm sorry.
Well, I felt like that was a lot of lead up to a not much of a story. I was expecting like some sort of a compromise. I was really geared up for something relating to torture.
I never made that promise. I never made that promise to you.
It was indicated. It was innuendo that suggested.
You have expectations. This is why people lose faith in people, right? We put on these false expectations, and then our role models fall down. I feel like I was once a role model.
This is why we're single. This is what's going
Speak
on.
Speak for yourselves, gentlemen. But this will be a little bit of a stretch, but I could say if you wanted to try to find maybe a compromise from the era, you could look at polygamy and its relationship with the United States. And I know that's stretching a bit and that's not perfect, but you know, you have the visions from Lorenzo Snow talking about how, you know, if we didn't like eradicate, it was Lorenzo Snow, right? How if we didn't eradicate it, he saw the government seizing our temples and our buildings and how the work would cease.
No, it was Wilford Woodruff. You're thinking
Sorry, I thought that might've been Woodruff. So it was Wilford Woodruff. And so I think that goes a little bit along with that.
Possibly,
trying
you can
to play
see
good
that.
Citizen. Yeah,
I mean, then of course that raises the question: did the Latter-day Saints give up polygamy, in order to become Americans? Right. I mean, it was. I mean, you could say that was Americanization at the barrel of a gun. So,
in a way, but it's not like it's on. It was on. I don't think at the time it would have been unheard of to sort of put the brakes on certain practices for the greater good of the church's survival. I mean, as far as we know, polygamy is still going to be an eternal practice, so it's not like...
Right, right. I was responding to the question of, okay, did Mormons, like, compromise their principles to...
Right.
Like, to go out of their way, like, to be proactive in their patriotism. Yeah. I don't see polygamy as being proactive in that.
I agree.
It as like,
I agree with
you
that.
Know, you know, we'd better concede. So,
hey...
So yeah, sorry to disappoint you.
No, you know, it's nothing. It's fine. It's whatever. Did you guys? I'm just curious about this. Did you guys have the lesson in priesthood this last Sunday on why women are nice?
We had ours a couple weeks ago.
We did not have
that
why women are nice lesson. No.
If was that weird to you, just in context of all the dialogue going on around women and. Sort of feminism and that kind of thing to have. As I sat in priesthood, I was just like, this feels really condescending to me.
I thought that my ward did a good job because the teacher did a really good job asking more constructive questions, I guess. I was in and out a little bit. I had some meetings, so I only caught like the back half of
mine read
lesson.
From the book.
Yeah. So, but I thought ours was good, what I observed, and it was fine. And of course, like, it's kind of funny sitting in a meeting like that, because with a topic like that, you never know. And my ward's got a pretty healthy balance between conservative and liberal guys, so it could go any direction, right? And I always get nervous because part of my charge, according to my stake president, is that I'm supposed to, like, be there to correct false doctrine in the event it comes up. So I'm always crossing my fingers like, please no one say anything stupid, because then I have to awkwardly put the brakes on this.
Yeah.
But I think it was okay. I mean, I could see why it might have been awkward for you, Al. We only had a brief moment where it might have seemed maybe some contention came up,
like,
but it was okay.
I was trying to understand what doctrine was trying to be taught in that lesson. And so, Russell, just so you know, coming up, there's a great one on, and it's just like, women are great. They did cool things in our history. Good job, women.
Interest.
And it's really exciting. Joseph F. Smith, or is it Joseph F. Smith? Apparently, he was a fan of women in general and thought that they were nice. But like, as we're talking about, I'm like, why are we having a lesson on this? Like, are we just that dumb? Why is there not a, like, we don't need a lesson on why men are good, but there is a lesson needed on why women are good, and there's no doctrine really taught in that. It was just women are nice. I felt like.
Well, and here's where it gets risky with with this kind of dialogue and this kind of discourse, because I mean there is a brand of people call it misogyny, or they almost call it a kind of benevolent misogyny, right? Or the benevolent patriarchy.
Yes.
Right? We're going to hold women up on this pedestal, and they are incapable of having impure thoughts. They are naturally inclined towards spirituality. Look how they're all wonderful mothers. And that's very nice, but we misunderstand who is building that pedestal. Are they building it for themselves, or are men building it for them and then expecting them to do this balancing act on this rather small pedestal? And then if they misstep, right, if they happen to not fit with what's required to be on this pedestal, like, well then what, right? They're the ones who fall off. And we look at it and say, why did you fall off that wonderful pedestal I made for you?
How dare you? How dare you fall
off? Well, I feel that way every time you've got the guy that's, sort of with a wink, it's like, oh, I just do whatever my wife tells me. Whatever she says goes, and I just do it. Oh, da, 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 da. And she's the best. She's just so great. And like, it feels, man, it just feels so patronizing to me. I'm like, come on, dude. How about a genuine compliment about something you love about your wife, instead of just, I'm so dumb. She's the only smart one here. She's the one who takes care of everything.
Yeah. And in my experience, that doesn't, like, we like to think that bodes well for positive gender relations, but it really doesn't, because you know,
it's not helping.
Yeah, right. It isn't affording them their right to be a person, right? The right to be a flawed human being like we all are, and we should be able to enjoy that ability, right? Women have the right to be wrong about things, or they have the right to be emotionally vulnerable, or this or that, just as we do.
You're a good feminist, Russell. I like you. we're going to get along just fine. Unlike Jeff, patronizing schmuck. sorry. Let's see. We can run through it.
I just
felt the need to like stab you as I walked
away.
Yeah,
for no reason. All I will say I thought about that lesson is like you're right, Al. I don't think it taught a lot of straight up doctrine per se. It was almost more like a survey of what women do in the church. And I did see some areas where it was constructive in that when we're absorbed in our own little world, and not as men, but just with what we do on our end of things in the church, we might not be aware of the responsibilities and opportunities that are given to women. And I don't just mean in like in the building a pedestal sense, but just that there's stuff we just might not honestly know as priesthood guys. Like, what is the actual role of the Relief Society? I bet you could talk to a lot of guys and they wouldn't really know what the mandate is right there.
To give people relief, obviously.
Yeah,
obviously.
To relieve people, right? And so I think there's plenty of stuff that we take for granted and don't fully know. And so there's nothing wrong with having a lesson that actually sort of breaks down the organization and responsibilities on the other side of the wall. Because we might not know the ins and outs of what they're doing, other than all the cliches that we have about, you know, crying and centerpieces and all that nonsense that we like to tease in our culture. You know, to know the real stuff that they are or should be up to. You know, it's good to know what our mandated responsibilities are in all genders or organizations or whatever else. But I agree with you. There was so much potential to have a very awkward, condescending, strange lesson that didn't need to necessarily.
We nailed it on that front. We did a great job. let's see. There's a quick article. We don't have to do all these, but we can do a couple. Right. There's an article on how Brian Regan is the Mormons' favorite comedian.
And by an article about it, it really means the last paragraph, the interviewer says, so Mormons are kind of India, huh? And he's like, yeah, I love them.
Jeff, the title of this article is Brian Regan is on top five Cosby, Mormons, and RFD-TV. So they mention Mormons and Brian Regan in the same headline. That's
isn't
the
top
takeaway.
Five Chris Rock's new very R-rated film?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Indeed.
How do we reconcile Brian Regan, the sinner who is in sinful entertainment, and our standards as Latter-day Saints people?
Here's a good thing. Like, Brian Regan is he's funny, and he's pretty much for the most part clean. And this is a distinct decision he made. So Brian Regan's been doing comedy for like 20 years.
He's been
years.
Around for a while, yeah.
And he had a spell of just being crap comedy, right? Like dirty jokes, the whole thing. And he made a deliberate decision to like go the clean route. He thought there was a better market for him there. And it's paid off very well. The man's done phenomenally well. But he hasn't always been there. It was a marketing move for him. Like for us it's more I personally listening to his show, I feel like he's shouting the entire time. I don't love the guy. I've never seen anybody be that upset over a box of Pop Tarts or something like that. And it
hey,
just
hey now
just,
like I've been upset. I can't, you haven't seen me when I go without my Pop Tarts. So
you've never tried to pull your hair out and throw a tantrum on a stage in front of 20,000 people over that box of Pop Tarts though. And so that's his bit. That's his
Al,
thing. And
you're a jerk. He's a visionary. How dare you?
He's like a Sufjan Stevens.
Sorry, that's a very old joke.
He's a forward looking visionary. I can't believe that you would speak ill of one of the great leading lights of this generation.
Sure. I mean, so the thing with Mormons and comedy though is I feel like Mormons in large part we're kind of starved for entertainment in a lot of ways. There's you know, we get a chunk of our movies are cut out automatically. We can't go see some of that good stuff. From a theater standpoint, there's a lot of it that, you know, we're just disqualified from because we're Mormon. We have to go have good stuff. So when a decent comedian comes around, we respond very, very positively and fall in love with them. And there's a couple of great ones. Obviously, we've had a friend of the show, Steve Solberg, has done some great comedy, and we had him on one time. Ryan Hamilton is also another comedian that happens to be LDS, but very clean routine, good comedy. And like my thing is, I wish I could get Mormons to like go after good comedy, go and support it, go and patronize it when it comes to town, and like go see these shows and make it happen for us. Because instead what we have is these goobers that end up making it big time. And I'm not sure how Brian Regan ever got a stage to himself, but the man is awful. There is way better comedy out there, people. That's the moral of this story.
Okay.
Don't support Brian Regan.
Editorial. I have no opinion on Brian Regan.
I have literally no opinion.
Do you care that he's like a Mormon icon?
I mean,
Jim Gaffigan or something.
To the extent that I am always a little bit weirded out that like when we pick our guy, right? So okay, you know, he's like, you know, he's the good non-Mormon or whatever, right? And then we hold him up on a pedestal. I never feel comfortable with that, and that's no different with Brian Regan. So.
Yeah. And then he's in a dirty show with Chris Rock, and what do? We just hope he tells Pop-Tart jokes.
That's all he's going to do. Guys.
Remember when Steve Young said no to Something About Mary because he didn't want his Mormon fans to go see it?
I was there. I remember.
That's a great
guys, thing. Someone asks Angela whether LDS bridal showers are out of control. Are they out of control?
What does that mean, out of control?
It means someone wrote, good old Angela Trusty, our friend, who says, dear Angela, I'm giving up on bridal showers.
Wait, she is our friend? I thought that she like promised to do stuff for us and never
did. She's like an unreliable narrator, but that's okay. I would like to support young women in their nuptials, especially as they're going to the temple, but she's basically frustrated that she's, Al, are you unwrapping stuff? What are you doing?
No, that's Russell.
Russell.
Russell's having M&M's.
You're messing with
butterscotch
hard candy
or
something? All right.
Was it really M&M's?
Well, Skittles, but close enough.
Oh, my gosh. That was a great guess.
Basically, he says that all the women 35 and older are also bringing home-building gifts, but the women 35 and younger bring nothing but intimate apparel. One shower I attended recently had 20 women in attendance, and half brought gifts of very intimate clothing or sexy sleepwear.
Hey, 10 outfits of lingerie, that's not bad.
It's like they want the future bride to get ready for a career in pole dancing.
Wait, this is what Angela says?
No, this is what the writer says. I can't even read that with a straight face.
Now here's my problem with this is we've got like these pure, simple-minded freshman BYU girls that are just appalled that anybody would think about sex at all. And how dare they? And how dare sex be something that you were looking forward to, or that was going to be any sort of fun with lingerie and things? Like we can be mature grown-ups about this and recognize. I mean, like just what? It's a wedding. That's the big part. That's a huge part of the wedding for a Mormon.
Well, I
married.
Do think it's understand
the fun sexy.
It's understandable
time.
Within Mormonism that we make a big deal about wedding night stuff. Because we hold off on it. But I also think we lend it a little bit too much weight. But I don't think it's outlandish at a bridal shower. I mean, obviously, I was not at a bridal shower. But I think it's pretty normal because it's kind of a big rite of passage. And it's like, hey, for the first time in your life, you're going to get sexy. So here's some sexy stuff from your friends who are already married and comfortable helping you out as you make this transition. Because I do feel that because of how... not sheltered, but how much we strive to be chaste and such in the church, that it's like this shock therapy when people get married. When
Russell, what's your view on lingerie?
Are you pro or against?
Pro or against? I am in support of healthy sexuality, right?
Yes.
That is a politician's
is
response.
For the sexy teddy.
But does lingerie contribute to healthy sexuality, or do you feel that it is a detraction from, you know, holiness?
I think that is a decision that should be left up to the individual couple.
No, take a stand, Russell.
That is my stand. I mean,
okay. I am for the blue boutique.
You know, whatever strengthens marriage, I am for.
In other quick news, guys, before we take off here, the church announced a dedication and open house dates for two new temples in 2015. They might be the only ones in 2015, which is sad news for those of you in Italy as the Rome temple continues to go along at a crawl, I guess. But on Friday, let's see, April 17th, the open house for the Cordoba Argentina temple will begin.
Oh, that was
Thank
good.
Thank you very
that
much. Really and then good. They'll dedicate it on May 17th. And then likewise, the Payson temple, Utah temple, which has been... just about done for a while now. is going to have its, where does it mention its open house on here? I'm missing it right here.
It's probably going to be at Payson, I bet.
Sorry, Payson open house will start Friday, April 24th until the 23rd of May. And then they'll have a cultural celebration. And I know the cultural of Southern Utah County is robust. And
what will they celebrate there?
And then after that, the
scone cutters.
Yeah. So that'll happen. And they'll have dedicatory sessions. But there we go.
They'll have a bunch of 20-year-olds playing signs.
Yeah. I don't know what you celebrate in Southern Utah County.
And don't forget the Festival of Colors. All right. That's.
Oh, my gosh. That is what we believe in if you are a freshman at BYU.
Yes.
So
we
other
have
than that,
appropriated a Hindu festival and made it our own.
That's what we do. Russell, by the way, hey, before we go, why don't you, where can people buy your book? Aren't you, or do you have any appearances coming up to promote said book?
Yes. What do you do? If you choose to subject yourself to seeing me, I bid you Godspeed in that. So
do not look at me.
tomorrow night I will be at Zion's Books in Provo doing a short presentation and a book signing.
That's
Wednesday night, though,
by the way, everybody.
That's the big event. Yeah. It's going to be at the Daughters of Utah Pioneers Museum. We're going to be having a Tamu Smith, who's one of the sisters in Zion, for those of you who do not know. She'll be emceeing the event. Tiffany Peterson Barker, a local vocalist, she'll be singing. But above all, the Genesis Group Choir will be favoring us with a number of songs.
Nice.
Just fantastic song, you know, old black spirituals, things like, you know, This Little Light of Mine, etc. So
I'm gonna let it shine.
It's gonna be a great, gonna be macarons and sparkling apple cider.
Is your book supposed to be $30 on Amazon?
Yes.
It's 450 pages. Good night.
Do you have a problem?
I'm gonna buy this and write a review. I'll be your first reviewer.
Are you sure? Well, I've already got a copy coming from Greg Coford Books, so that we can review.
Yeah,
it.
You know what? You just that gave me $1.50, gentlemen. So I will.
Oh, good.
Why don't you self-publish?
I have self-published, actually.
And did you make more money doing that?
In that case, yes, I did make. I haven't made any money with this yet, actually, because very few copies have had the chance to be sold.
Right.
So we'll see.
Russell, how can we help you make a living so that you can continue?
Dude, this is a side project, okay? All right.
Okay.
This is something.
Being an author of 450 page books is a side project?
Truly. Like, it was something I did in the off hours last year. So,
Jeff, what did you do in your off hours? I was playing Mario Kart.
In grad school? yeah, I don't know what I did. Off hours, I would like watch movies.
Jeez.
Documentaries. Jeez. Documentaries on social justice issues. Am I right? Come on. Just
there was no Netflix yes. when I was in grad school. These random Netflix documentaries were not an option for me. It wasn't going to happen.
Sad.
For shame.
We've tried to work out with this publisher to get a TWIM discount. It's still in the works. So if you buy from Greg Coford Books, if they have a promo code, just type in something like TWIM and see if it works. We don't guarantee it though, but maybe they'll get the message. So we're just trying to help out Russell, guys. So hopefully
just apply a bunch of bad coupon codes.
Yeah.
And tell them we sent you.
Tell them we sent you. And if it's, right. and if it doesn't work, call their customer service and say, This Week in Mormon sent me here. Why are you not hooking me up with that sweet 15% off that I seek?
And I need all the Skittles I can get. Remember, every book you buy is one more bag of Skittles
for me.
One
bag of Skittles.
The company Tongs gives a pair of shoes for every pair of shoes sold, but Russell Stevenson will receive Skittles if you buy his book, everyone. So, you know, priorities.
Priorities.
He's just as good. All right. Well, but, dude, it's been great. Russell, thanks for coming back on, man. I know you're busy with finals.
No, it's
stuff.
Been, you know, I always love coming on with This Week in Mormons. It's one of my favorite appearances, truly.
Can we get you on the record? Will you say the verbatim? Say, This Week in Mormons is my favorite Mormon podcast. Go.
This Week in Mormons is my favorite Mormon podcast.
Yes!
Thank you.
Other than my own.
We did it.
Oh, that's fair. That's fair.
Well, sure. Yeah, yeah. And you do the Mormon History Guy,
yeah.
right?
Mormon History Guy.
And keep that.
You can go listen to Russell. I've listened to your interview with Robert Millett a couple of times. I really like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, have you? That, you know, that was one of my favorite interviews to do too. And I'm going to need to add a PS because Richie Stedman's Cultural Hall, it's pretty close neck and neck tie between you two.
Oh, screw you, Stevenson.
Do not speak his name.
How dare you? Oh, my goodness.
Voldemort. Get off my phone!
How did I know this would provoke you? I knew this would provoke you. And
we love Richie. He's a wonderful human being. He's a terrific individual. I'm full of love for all. All
right. Well, everybody, we got a week for one more week of Christmas songs on Sunday. I hope you all get to sing Angels We Have Heard on High two more times before the holiday is over. And as always, you can reach us, contact at This Week in Mormons, or visit thisweekinmormons.com and see what we're doing.
By the way, if you happen to need to send me an email for something, my name is spelled with a G. Okay, thanks for everyone who is emailing
Jeff,
me.
I'll
like
add
Jeffrey Chaucer, people. Jeffrey Chaucer.
So if you need to send me an email, don't do it JEFF at thisweekinmormons.com or it goes to our server and Al has to send me stuff. And it's been a crazy weekend for that.
Jeff, I'll just add you as an alias. I mean, calm down.
Oh, fine. Jeez. Folks, please join us on Facebook and on Twitter and on Instagram and all those great things. And we hope you'll subscribe to our show if you like what you hear. That's always nice of you. And that's it. Russell, once again, we wish you well, and we will see it through that your book becomes a bestseller. That's our goal.
Right. Fantastic. We'll
see you guys.
Take care, gentlemen.
All right. Bye, guys. Bye, y'all. Everyone, another episode of This Week in Mormons is over. Hope you have a great week, and have a great Christmas season, too. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.